This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends.
Kara, welcome to Bookends with Maureen Rat and Ruth Todd, and welcome back, Maureen.
Thank you. I've been to the other side of the world, survived, and come back again.
Yes, so we're very pleased to see you.
Well, it's going to be a very busy time in the next 6 weeks because it's the run-up until the Word Festival, and I hope people are getting programs and looking at the events. And my guest today is Branavan Gananalingam, who is one of the writers who's going to be here at the festival talking about his new novel.
And my guest is Jennifer Howarth, who has been to Vienna about 10 or 11 times as a journalist. And this time she had all her diaries and notes, and she went back to explore again and focus really on the history around 1919 after the First World War, and the art and the music. Historian Jennifer Howarth began her writing career as a travel writer, and for more than 20 years she travelled the world and wrote travel stories for leading newspapers and magazines in New Zealand and overseas. She's a published author of 8 books on history and travel and 3 novels. As well, she's written the 3 novels I should mention, Hobson's Chance, Lost Souls and The Undone Years, which I equally enjoyed, as well as your travel writing, Jennifer. And also the biography of Robert McDougall, Forgotten Philanthropist, which is an important Christchurch book, as he was a philanthropist who donated the Robert McDougall Art Gallery to Christchurch in 1932. But today we're talking about Vienna behind the facades, and this is a personal journey for you, and it's amazingly full of so much. I have to go back and read bits again because it's a great book to dip into, really, because for me it's the history, the art and the music that were my favourite parts, but they all blend in wonderful photographs. So tell me how you came to do this.
Well, it came really, I suppose I first grew interested in Vienna as a child when I was taken to see The Merry Widow. And it was this wonderful world of princes and princesses, which as a 6-year-old can't fail to impress you. But I didn't actually get to Vienna until I was in my early 30s. And when I got there, I found it an intriguing city. At that stage, it was very poor. It was quite run down. It was very cheap. But you could tell that there was no real interest in what had happened in Vienna after 1918. So I really wanted to find out, and I probably spent the next 10 visits finding out a little more and a little more about the history of Vienna from 1918. But it was also to try and fit into that world, the world of the music and the art, which I'd always liked, and that became part of the society which I wrote about, so I could show how it was produced from this incredible society that was Vienna, particularly before the First World War.
And it was the history that I knew very little about. And the research must have been tremendous. Did you keep diaries from all those trips?
Oh, yes. Every time I went away on a travel trip, I always wrote a diary, either by hand or later with a computer. But I had diaries back until 1977, I had letters which I wrote home about the course I went to at the university there. And they were very useful. And I had all the papers about the course.
Yes, this was a journalist in you, wasn't it?
That's right. Yes, I couldn't resist it.
And so I was surprised how poor they were. And go after the First World War, that was all new to me.
It was a terror. It was really very sad. I mean, all the wars are bad, and but Vienna in particular suffered terribly after the First World War because they'd been taken over by Germany during the war, and their people had been forced to fight in areas they didn't want to. The empire had broken up, so it was no longer a possibility. People who had had jobs with the imperial service had lost all their jobs. Everybody lost money, and yet this incredible society came out of that, which is called Red Vienna, which was run by the socialists, and they did tremendous work developing better housing, better facilities for children and education, everything else within the city, which had no money. And that was one of the stories which is only gradually being uncovered now in Vienna. In fact, the only time I've been to an exhibition on it was in 2019. When goodness. I went back for the last time, and it was all there.
100 years
afterwards, and they were having the exhibition because it was 100 years after. And the history of Vienna, which was a museum which I used a great deal, had nothing on it, but it's been refurbished and it will have it on it now. So it's amazing how they didn't talk about it.
That's right. And and then the Second World War came, and almost the First World War was forgotten in some ways, wasn't it?
It was, yes. The Second World War, there's a very good museum in Vienna, which again I spent time with. Gerhardt is the owner of it. It's a private museum, and it's on the Third Man, which is probably the greatest study of Vienna after the Second World War that was ever made. And I used that quite extensively because it showed me exactly what it was like to live in that city as a broken city, because it was. I mean, it was bomb damage everywhere. The pictures show this in the book.
There's so much in this book. We can't cover nearly any, not really a larger part of it, but it's to dip into, I feel, too. It's the sort of book that I will go back to. I'm never likely to get to Vienna now, but I'm getting older, but there's so much in it, and you tie it all together. That's the secret of this book. And we, you know, all the musicians that I think I know about, there's more about them, there's more about the artists. It's a cultural journey too, isn't it?
It is, really. And one of the things I found very interesting was that before the First World War, Vienna was a city of salons, and people from all walks of life, whether they were scientists or artists or musicians, would meet in these wonderful sort of drawing rooms, yes, often run by Jewish women, who and they would discuss their ideas. And as one of the historians says, there was a cross-fertilization of ideas in Vienna because it was a smaller capital than there was in London or Paris, where you tended to be a musician or an artist. But in Vienna, they everything all mixed together.
Yes.
And Klimt in particular is very much a representation of that, because he was part of the art world, but he was also very involved in the music, and Beethoven was his favourite musician, and they had exhibitions. And of course, his famous Beethoven frieze is back in the Secessionist House, and it's the most wonderful study of the Ode to Joy and the whole of that wonderful, wonderful symphony, which he has pictures on the wall. And you go in there, it took me an hour to go through and look at it and sit there. And it's three walls, and you look at it all, and it's all full of symbolics, figures representing the various stages of his symphony as Klimt saw it.
So when you were doing your research and revisiting all of this, and that you had visited before, did you have any, how did you know what to leave out, really, of this book, because there was so much to put in?
I think I learnt what people go and see. I mean, it's called Behind the Facades for a very good reason, in that it's supposed to take any visitor who goes there, or a person who's interested in Vienna, beyond what they see. So if you go to the Hofburg, it tells you the story of Sissy and Franz Joseph and their life, and how the terrible things that happened to her, and in a way, the way she rose above it with her poetry and her freedom and her living right around Europe. So it takes that story on, or in the Schönbrunn, the story of Maria Theresa and the way she worked for the people, and she was a really, she was probably one of the best Austrian empresses there ever was, or emperors, because she really did try and reform the empire in a way that helped. And so it tells you about that. If you go to the art gallery, it's the story of the artists there, or yes, a concert, the story of the musicians, and how they represented the society they lived in.
You've mentioned Klimt and Beethoven. Were they your favourites?
I love Klimt. I really do. I said in the book that, you know, I learned about them when I went to Vienna in 1977. I knew nothing about them till then. I found Schiller at that stage incredibly difficult. He was more explicit sexually than I was prepared to accept, which I find very interesting now because it shows how I've changed and also how the world has changed, because we now look at Klimt and think he is a very great artist of the Expressionist period. But when I first saw him, I thought, oh, I don't know that I can cope with that.
Dragged into the modern world.
when you see the pictures in the book, you'll know why I'm saying that.
Yes, and they are beautiful, beautiful photographs and pictures. They took me by surprise, really. I was getting to that, and then there were several, and there were some coloured and some black and whites. And how did you gather all those?
Well, a lot of them were provided by the institutions in Vienna. I mean, you can't take pictures in the Hofburg or the Schönbrunn, so they actually sent us pictures from there. The Belvedere sent us wonderful pictures of their artworks. I said, can I use the press kit? Yes, certainly. The Hundertwasser Museum also contributed some wonderful artworks. So they were very good at helping and offering me pictures, which was a great help because the budget for the book was not able to buy, you know, pictures at $100 a time.
No, but there's just, I just was amazed when I got to the end. I thought, I'm going to read this at least twice and then put it aside and come back to it lots and tell other people find this book, because I haven't found anything so comprehensive on anywhere, I don't think. And you've taken Vienna as your love and your, it's not a travel guide, it's not just a history, but it's, as you said, behind the facades. And it's a lifelong love that comes through the pages.
I think that was what I was hoping to do. When I started to write it, I thought, this has got to be really good if it's going to sell, if it's going to be interesting to other people. And it's got to be about what I see, because lots of people write about Vienna. But it's my vision. It's my vision as a New Zealander of the city and what it meant. And I grew up in a world where Germany and Austria were the enemies initially, and therefore I wasn't really allowed to be part of that world because they were outside. I wasn't allowed to learn German, for instance, at school.
No, definitely not.
Definitely not. So I wanted to know what this world was like. And in the end, I did find it fascinating. And I felt, I mean, it was the stories. Some of them are good. Some of them are terrible. And that's part of the fascination of the city is that there is this good and there's also this terrible story that lies behind it all.
It's got everything. So look for Vienna, Behind the Facades, A Personal Journey from Jennifer Harworth. It's a story of her lifelong love affair with Vienna. And it's a memoir, partly a memoir that pulls back the curtains and reveals the secrets. It's the secrets of a city that come out of those pages. And it's celebrated in all her beauty, her culture and her grandeur, but shameful aspects of her past and her influential role on the world stage are also explored. Stories that even today can make you wonder how this wonderful city survived at all. So Behind the Facades, A Personal Journey from Jennifer Harworth. And it's published by your publishing company, Wiley Publications. Yes, and we credit the book production, design and layout to Quentin Wilson Publishing. So, Jennifer, congratulations. It's quite remarkable.
Thank you very much, indeed. I love talking to you about it.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.
Slow Down Your Hair is Wellington writer Branavan Gananalingam's
third novel. Both his earlier novels, Spriggs and Sodden Downstream, were shortlisted for the Fiction Prize in the Ockham New Zealand Book Awards, and Spriggs then won the Nio Marsh Award for Crime Fiction. I'm not sure if I want to define or attempt to define this latest novel from Bran, because it had quite an extreme effect on me when I was reading it. And I think we'll explore that when I talk. Bran, do you want to try and define it? Because when you look at the outside of the book and you read the, you know, what's on the back cover, it doesn't really prepare you, does it, for what's going to unfold?
No, I was quite deliberate, I think, in how I did this, and Murdoch, who's my publisher, and I spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out how best to market this without, I guess, giving anything away. And I, funnily enough, I think I studied a little bit how Psycho, the Hitchcock film, was marketed as a way of figuring out how I could talk about this book. And essentially it was to talk about the setup and then not talk about anything else, and then hope that that will help at least give enough pique enough interest, but then not ruin, I guess, what happens in the rest of the book. But in my head, I guess I wrote this book as a horror novel, and questioning to what extent can we seek pleasure in a world that's kind of increasingly unequal and resources are scarce. That was my thinking when I wrote the book. I don't think that necessarily comes out, I think, in the marketing.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I had read one review, but it was pretty. It didn't go into any particular detail. It was just sort of teasing out some of the themes. And I'm glad I hadn't read any of the others when I started in, because, you know, the pleasure, if you can call it pleasure, of reading a book like this is to not know, not have any idea of what is going to happen. So how do you write a book like this that has two separate narratives, one that's kind of going along and the other one is ramping and ratcheting up in tension?
Yeah, I almost treated the two narratives in quite different ways. So the one narrative in my head was kind of a romantic, wouldn't say necessarily romantic comedy, but it had an element of romance to it. I was thinking of books, writers like Elena Ferrante and filmmakers like Eric Rohmer, these people who talk about, I guess, affairs and class and kind of this wish fulfillment, but the kind of reality of that. So I was thinking about those writers and filmmakers with that narrative, and then I was thinking about horror with the other one. But I guess the overall structure for me was actually based a little bit on Stephen King's Misery, because I really loved the way in Misery, the way the romance narrative in that, you know, the writer was forced to write while he was held hostage kind of delayed the tension, or ramped up the tension, because it kept delaying the narrative and it kept digressing and you kept going, I don't want to hear about this stupid romance story, but because I want to get back to Can He Escape the Room? But you also know that the romance story was so important in his ability to stay alive in that context of that book, because otherwise his captor would turf him out. So I was kind of using, I guess, the elements of a romance novel to ramp up the tension of the other narratives. So it was definitely a deliberate interplay, but it was also quite fun to write.
Yeah, and you had the effect on me, definitely. I actually had to stay awake for quite a long time because I was so terrified of what was going to happen on the, you know, as you say, on the horror side. So let's look at the romantic comedy, romantic comedy element. Although it's sad, it's the lived experience of three people who, you know, are subjected to racism and and have an immigrant experience that we know about, but some of us have been lucky enough not to have to experience.
Yeah, I guess in my head I was thinking there are a couple of things at play, I guess, in that section of the narrative. I was really interested in writing a domestic narrative in the context of immigrant cultures, and I'm not sure how frequently that's been done in New Zealand, so I was quite keen to explore that as subject matter. And each of the three characters, in some respect, are kind of removed from dominant cultures, but also are closer or more successful. So Vishal, the husband, is not doing very well economically and mentally. He's really struggling with his job as a taxi driver. He deals with the racism up front with drunk passengers. Whereas someone like Ashwin, who's the love interest, he's much more successful, I guess, on the face of it, because he, the professional, is doing very well, I guess, relative to Vishal, but is much is also similarly unhappy, I guess, with where he's got to, because I guess the barriers and the structures within the place that he's working in wouldn't necessarily let him progress as he wanted to. Whereas Kavita is just, I guess, in my head, was just trying to get by, being a parent and juggling work and full-time housework, essentially.
Yes, so the opportunity to go to Waiheke with Ashwin, an old flame, just becomes too tempting, and she goes. And Waiheke's a great place to satirise, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, I think what I wanted to also have the sense of is the way Kavita and Ashwin kind of, I guess, invest so much in something else as a kind of in lieu of their relationship almost, and that they were so desperate for something, whether it's to relive the past or to create a new future, that a place like Waiheke kind of stands in really well, even if it's completely indifferent to them, that somewhere external, somewhere different, somewhere which is essentially a different landmass to the mainland North Island, becomes this kind of place where they hope that something could happen, but it doesn't obviously work out that way, or doesn't necessarily work out as easily as they hoped it would.
Yeah, we invest a lot in these kind of holiday destinations, don't we, to change our lives,
yeah,
or take us out of ourselves. And I think you did a pretty good job of showing us that that doesn't always happen. It brings you right up close to who you are and what's going on in your life.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I also wanted to say is that in the book is that, yes, you can seek pleasure, but we're also part of a web of social relations and part of a web of other commitments and people who also depend on us. So that I can understand the impulse that people have to look after themselves and be do something for themselves, but it can also be difficult to balance that when you have other obligations which you can't just ignore.
Yeah, and that's well, I'm hesitating to say what I was going to say. Yeah, and that's the tension, isn't it, of what's going on one hand and what's going on the other, and how long it takes for the responsibilities to kick in, and will they kick in time for there to be a happy end? Well, it's not really going to be a happy ending, is it? Because
no,
life doesn't deliver a happy ending.
Yeah, that's right. And I think part of the backdrop of writing this novel was it was dealing with COVID, and I think part of my thinking and the cynicism, which perhaps is in the book, is I was looking at COVID and I was looking at the way there was something that was so upfront about COVID. People were dying in their millions around the world, and yet there are plenty of people who are refusing to do anything about it. And I was kind of going, well, we've got a pretty gigantic issue coming up with climate change, and well, that's currently also an issue. And thinking that if we couldn't even deal with COVID, where it was so apparent that something needed to be done, how on earth are we going to deal with something like climate change? And the kind of feeling of unease and discomfort, thinking about the future, I think also feeds into the book quite a bit.
Yeah, certainly does. And the cover, once you've read the book, you go back, as I say, and you look at the book again and think how you were seduced into it, which is what should happen. And then you look at the cover and go, oh my goodness, there it is. I should have realised. It's a very unsettling cover once you know what's between the covers.
Yeah. I was. It's quite funny because I think the combo of the cover, the epigram, and the first line, I think give a pretty clear sense of what the book is going to be in hindsight. But it's amazing the way narratives work is that you don't really pick up that stuff until you go back in hindsight and realise what's happened. So I kind of laid all these landmines, I think, in that first part of the book, and also with the cover, which I was really lucky that Dilahana Lakamge, who did the cover, that was her interpretation of the book, that these kind of factors come into play.
Well, I hope we've not ignited any of those landmines in this discussion, but we've piqued the interest of people to go on and find and read it for themselves, because I think they're in for a treat, if that's the right word to say. But, you know, we read for all sorts of reasons, don't we? And we read to be unsettled, and we read to be challenged.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to make sure that this book is something that could be read, I think, quickly and ostensibly seems relatively straightforward. My background is film, and the idea for this novel was originally a film script. So I viewed it as a film, and the structures around it and the way the narrative works was based on film. So I'm hoping that kind of filmic aspect comes through in the way when you read it.
Great. Thank you. And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.